Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, June 19, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our topic is the new book, Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department, by Hans von Spakovsky and John Fund. A link to that book has been provided to you in the notice of today's call. It's also available on the website of the Federalist Society, and of course it's available at Amazon.com and at other major outlets. We're pleased to welcome today the authors, the co-authors of the book, who are going to provide opening remarks for us in turn, and then take audience questions. I am, by the way, Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. And a reminder that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and as always, or as often is the case, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear first from co-author John Fund. He's the National Affairs columnist at National Review and a Fox News analyst, and he'll be followed in his opening remarks by Hans A. von Spakovsky. He's the Senior Legal Fellow and Manager of the Civil Justice Reform Initiative at the Heritage Foundation here in Washington, D.C. And with that, Mr. John Fund, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean, and I especially want to thank the Federalist Society audience because many people in the Federalist Society, whether they be law professors or practitioners or people working in government as lawyers, were of great help to us in the book, not only as sources but as fact-checkers or research resources. So the book is a collaborative effort in every sense of the word, not only between Hans and myself, but also a great many Federalist Society members and others. Obviously, this audience today knows the importance of the Justice Department. It's the most powerful federal agency. It's the one that probably has the most impact on the lives of Americans. 115,000 employees, a very large budget, enormous prosecutorial discretion in a wide range of areas across 40 sub-agencies and task forces. And it's very important that the Attorney General of the country take seriously his dual role. On the one hand, he's a political appointee of the president. He has a responsibility to carry out the president's priorities when it comes to law enforcement, to set a different tone and direction, to emphasize certain things in the president's agenda. At the same time, though, he's an officer of the court. He's a legal official. He has to follow the rule of law. He has to balance the political needs of the office with the legal requirements. And sadly, as we've discovered in our analysis and investigation of Eric Holder, this is the first full-length investigation of his Justice Department, Eric Holder has fallen very badly short of that standard. Whenever there's been a fork in the road and he had to choose between political priorities and legal necessities, too often, in fact, almost in every case, he has chosen the political priorities. And just to give you an example of how extreme some of the arguments and politicized the arguments have gotten, let's look at the Supreme Court and how they've addressed the Eric Holder's Justice Department's arguments in court. In the last 2.5 years alone, the Supreme Court has ruled 12 or 13 times against the government, 9-0. 9-0. That would include Sonia Sotomayor, President Obama's own appointee to the court. It would include Elena Kagan, who was President Obama's own Solicitor General in the Justice Department. Just this morning, Hans informs me, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously against the Internal Revenue Service in the Treasury Department in a case involving taxpayers' rights to discover certain evidence and to question the motives of IRS officials engaged in enforcement actions. So once again, we may see other unanimous decisions before the court's term is out in which the Justice Department has been shot down. These cases, these 13 cases, involve a wide range of areas from Freedom of Information Act law to religious freedom to property rights to tax law. Across a wide range of areas, the Obama administration's attempt to aggrandize and to accumulate more power in the executive branch has been shot down unanimously by the court. Most people are aware of the Sackett versus EPA decision, where a couple in Idaho was prevented from developing some of their land, and the EPA took the extraordinary position of, you not only can't sue us in court, you have to pay fines of up to $75,000 a day while we try to block you from ever having any redress of grievances in court. The Supreme Court was not amused by that. There's also the Jones case of last year, where the Justice Department contended in court that the government should have the right to put a GPS tracking device on anyone's car without a search warrant, without a court order, without even any evidence of a crime being committed or being planned. That was an outrageous assertion, which was shot down 9-0. We also had the assertion a couple of years ago where the government in open court, with people gasping, admitted that they may have the power to censor books, prevent books from being published. That was in the Citizens United case, I believe. And although Citizens United was not unanimous by any means, that reasoning was certainly rejected by the court as a whole. So obviously the book covers many other areas, national security, business law, abuse of the power of subpoena, where Eric Holder has ultimately been held in contempt of the House of Representatives for refusing to turn over documents in the horrific Fast and Furious scandal. But for a lot of that detail, we'd like to leave it to questions, and also Hans can cover some of those areas as well, since those are areas of his expertise, Hans being a former Justice Department official, as well as a former commissioner for the Federal Election Commission.
Well, John's really covered a lot of it. I will say that as a former employee at the Justice Department, even I, frankly, was surprised when we were talking to sources doing our research at the really full degree of lawlessness and contempt for the rule of law that Holder has injected into the Justice Department. Numerous folks told us that he has politicized the department in a way really never seen before. And, you know, one former employee of the department who was hired during the Clinton administration told us that, in his opinion, Holder was the worst attorney general since John Mitchell under Richard Nixon, which is really saying something. It's very clear that what drives Holder is politics and ideology and loyalty to the president, not the interests of justice. And while everyone recognizes that an attorney general is picked by a president, they are supposed to and have to draw the line between loyalty to the president and keeping up the interests of justice. The professional and ethical requirements of an attorney general override, or supposed to anyway, override partisan political concerns. But as John said, every time there's been a choice between those two, the attorney general has clearly gone with politics. It's very clear that Holder thinks of himself as part of the president's political team first, attorney general second. Some may claim that this is just a partisan attack on Holder. It is not. I mean, we make it very clear in the book. Look, we've had very good attorney generals of both parties who have carried out their duties and responsibilities the way we expect an attorney general to do that. But, you know, the reason we came up with the name of the book, Obama's Enforcer, is because that is, frankly, a very apt description of Holder. Because every time that President Obama has broken, bent, or changed the law in his huge expansion of executive authority, the person that's been there at his side as his legal advisor telling him how to get around the law, it has been Eric Holder. And it's very clear that Holder does not think that the law is a limit or a barrier to what he does. We got the latest example of this just a week ago when he announced that the Justice Department plans to fund legal representation for many of the illegal aliens that are surging across the border in one of the biggest scandals and, frankly, crises that we've had along the southern border in a very long time. Well, the problem with that, whether you agree with that from a public policy standpoint or not, is that that's illegal. He can't do that. There's a provision in federal immigration law that prohibits that, and yet the attorney general just blithely ignores that and says he's going to go ahead with it. The motto, you know, of the Justice Department on its seal, in Latin, roughly translated, it means "He who prosecutes on behalf of justice." What we found from our research and talking to many sources was that Holder has apparently changed that to he who prosecutes on behalf of his political and ideological allies. Thank you.
Well, thank you both, gentlemen. I should have mentioned at the outset that John Fund is going to be with us just for the first 30 minutes of the call. So let me revert to John Fund briefly as I'm unmuting his telephone and see if he wants to augment his statement at all, or should we turn right to the audience for their questions, John?
Well, I just wanted to emphasize something that, Hans has said, which is the Justice Department has been operating in a fashion completely distinct from previous administrations of both parties. For example, the last two or three terms, they've won only 40% of their cases before the Supreme Court. The average in the last half century or beyond is 70%. Failure rate is two times that of Bill Clinton's administration, more than three times that of George W. Bush's administration. The courts, not just the Supreme Court, but courts lower down, and I think we're going to see more of these decisions as the months go on and as the administration's brazen approach to executive power is more obvious, I think we're going to see the courts more and more assert themselves. And basically, the pattern will be courts deciding this administration is a rogue body. It is not operating within the normal constraints, the guardrails of executive branch power, the separation of powers, and it will increasingly be slapped down, as it should be.
Yeah, and to just add to that very quickly, Dean, look, I know from experience that, in general, federal courts and federal judges give a lot of discretion and defer often to the Justice Department and Justice Department lawyers because they have this trust in the ethical and professional conduct of those lawyers. But I got to tell you, after having worked with John to put this book together, that I think judges need to reconsider that. You know, we found case after case after case of the Holder Justice Department where judges threw out prosecutions that they were pursuing, and the judges said that prosecutorial abuse was behind the cases and behind what the prosecutors were doing. You know, that
now, Hans, you should mention the Louisiana case, Hans.
Oh yeah, I mean, one of the cases we talk about in the book is a case involving the prosecution of New Orleans police officers because of events that happened right after Hurricane Katrina. The judge in that case issued one of the most scathing indictments I have ever read of the misbehavior of Justice Department prosecutors, including people not just in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Orleans, but lawyers inside the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department. And the behavior was so bad that the judge referred those lawyers to bar associations for disciplinary actions. And by the way, it included the attorneys involved in the cases making anonymous postings at the Times-Picayune newspaper website in which they attacked the defendants in the case, the defendants' lawyers, and one of the people making those postings was the taint lawyer at the Civil Rights Division. That's the lawyer that, for lawyers who are familiar with this know, that's the lawyer who was designated as the person to make sure that the prosecution team did not use evidence in the prosecution that they were not entitled to use, such as the statements that the police officers gave to the internal affairs investigators, because as most people, most lawyers may know, police officers can't assert the Fifth Amendment when they're talking to internal investigators, and so that information is not allowed to be used in a subsequent criminal prosecution. And yet the taint lawyer, the person who had been assigned to make sure that the defendant's rights were not being violated by the government, was one of the people making anonymous postings attacking the defendants. That individual still works in the Civil Rights Division. She's neither been terminated nor disciplined, as has another lawyer, another employee we talk about, who admitted committing perjury to the Inspector General's office in an investigation of the Civil Rights Division. That person was not disciplined, was not terminated. In fact, she was treated as a hero by the Holder Justice Department because of the behavior that she engaged in was against people perceived to be conservative employees within the department.
And I take it, this is Dean Reuter, I take it that these and other stories are all cataloged in your book.
That's right. Yeah, you know, we're not just making charges or allegations. I mean, the book is filled with actual cases, and in fact, lots of quotes from court opinions where judges are saying that the department engaged in wrongdoing.
Do we ever end up with some court-imposed sanctions against some of these actors? Is that how, the way some of these stories end, or...
Well, in most of the cases, the judges simply tossed out the prosecution's case, which in itself is quite a statement. But as I said, in the Louisiana case, the judge actually referred the matter to the bar associations, bar association down in Louisiana, for disciplinary actions against the lawyers.
All right. Well, we're talking to the co-authors of Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. They are Hans von Spakovsky and John Fund. Let's turn to the audience to see if it's on their mind today. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either John Fund or Hans von Spakovsky, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who might ring in here, let me make a quick announcement. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., we've just scheduled a new conference call that you other a telephone conference call that you otherwise have not heard about. It concerns Alice Corp versus CLS Bank. That's a Supreme Court case decided this morning. It's an important patent case that concerns the patentability of software and other matters. Next week, we'll have a full slate of cases, full slate of telephone calls, some of which will cover cases yet to be decided and announced by the Supreme Court on Monday and then on Thursday. Today, though, our topic is Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. We're here with the co-authors. Let's take our first caller.
I've been notified I have the floor. This is John Rowland, Constitution.org.
We can hear you just fine. Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, all of this may be true, but the question is, what can we do about it? Because it's not just a problem with the Justice Department. And unfortunately, there have been so many appointments made and the culture of the department so changed that simply replacing Holder is not likely to remove the problem. So we have a fundamental reform ahead of us, and it's important that it be made, but we need to be clear how we're going to proceed. An attempt to be made to impeach him, the Senate would not remove him, so that would be a futile gesture that would probably not be well received by the voting public. So then the question is, short of replacing the president with a member of the opposite party in the next election, what can we really do about it? And what can we do to prevent it from happening in the future? If we try to make it an issue in the next election, but most voters are not going to understand these issues.
Boy, I'll tell you, John and I talk about that in the last chapter of the book, which is called "What Is to Be Done," and you've put your finger on a very difficult problem. We spoke to some former attorney generals, and they all said there's not that much that can be done about the internal structure of the Justice Department to prevent this. I mean, it all depends on having good leadership, and you've got to get a good attorney general in who's going to try to clean some of this up. But there are limits on what they can do. Now the other possibility that we talk about in the book is giving the Inspector General of the Justice Department authority over the wrongdoing of and ethical violations of the lawyers within justice. You know, right now, that is supposedly investigated by the Office of Professional Responsibility. But one of the things we do in the book is talk about how badly run the OPR is, and how right now there's basically a political crony of Holder's heading up that office, who isn't about to issue any reports that would make Holder look bad. And that office reports directly to the Attorney General, so it's got a very clear conflict of interest. The other thing we talk about in the book is, and this is something we haven't really covered yet, is that something else that the Holder Justice Department has been doing is it has been engaging in massive sue and settle litigation. In other words, collusive litigation with its political allies. And this has happened quite a bit in the environmental area. You know, the situation here is that the administration may want to issue a regulation in a particular area where it really doesn't have the authority to do it. And what they have been doing is they've been going to their political allies in the environmental movement and other areas and saying, look, why don't you sue us, claiming that we should have issued this regulation and we violated federal law by not doing it. And then as soon as the lawsuit is filed, rather than actually fighting it, the Justice Department very quickly says, oh, we'll settle the case. And they draft out a settlement agreement that basically does everything they want to, cuts out the ability of the public to review any kind of new regulations, and courts tend to rubber stamp these settlements. And, you know, when Ed Meese was the Attorney General, he actually issued an internal memo at the Justice Department that tried to stop that kind of collusive settlements. This administration tossed that memo out, and frankly, provisions of that, I think Congress should think about making them federal law.
I might just add that I think another thing that needs to be done is, and this has to probably wait for the next president, Congress is very interested in passing legislation that would clarify and codify Congress's ability to get standing in federal court if it's challenging the constitutionality of an executive branch action. I think there clearly is an issue where the administration can basically run out the clock on almost anything that it does, because either it's difficult to prove standing for members of Congress to sue, or alternately, all of these things are done on a very slow track, and the administration can leave office before the issue of whether or not its actions are constitutional is ever resolved.
Well, let's see what's on the mind of our next caller. Take another question here. Go ahead, caller. I think we lost that caller. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple questions lined up here, and then our lines are free.
Yes, the Office of Professional Responsibility was covered. What about the Office of Legal Counsel? Has that been infiltrated and warped?
Yeah, John, I don't know if you want to talk about that or you want me to, but I'll just say very briefly, then John could add in. The answer is yes.
Why don't you handle it, Hans, because I'm probably only going to be on the line for another 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay. No,
in fact, why don't you address the OLC?
We talk about that very issue in the book, and the fact that for those who don't know, and I'm sure most of our colleagues, you know, the Office of Legal Counsel has always been the office within justice that provides advice to the president, particularly on the constitutionality of proposed legislation, on actions of the executive branch. And it has always adhered to the highest standards. And as evidence of that, you could just look at one issue that we actually talk about in the book, and that is the fact that ever since the Kennedy administration, it didn't matter whether there was a Republican or a Democrat in the White House, you know, they issued a legal opinion, which I believe is absolutely correct, saying that if the District of Columbia wanted to get a voting member of Congress that had to be done through a constitutional amendment. It couldn't be done through legislation. And that opinion has been maintained by OLC, as I said, from administration to administration. Eric Holder was very unhappy with that when he came in, and he went to the Solicitor General's office and got them to issue him an opinion on that. This was right when he first got in and when a bill was being pushed through Congress to provide D.C. with a voting representative. And then he proceeded, as he settled in his tenure, to change OLC, to get someone in there who would issue him the opinions that he wanted. And the best and most resounding example of the kind of corruption that he has caused in OLC is when you look at the unlawful recess appointments that the president made to the National Labor Relations Board. After that occurred, people started saying, well, you know, what legal basis did you have to do that? And the Office of Legal Counsel then issued an opinion saying that what the president had done was perfectly legal. This legal opinion wasn't drafted until after the president's actions. And as we point out in the book, the opinion is in parts laughable. I mean, it is an embarrassment. I've talked to OLC veterans who tell me that opinion is an embarrassment to the previous high quality and high standards of that office, because it was very clear that that opinion, they came up with the conclusion that they wanted, that what the president had done was constitutional, and then filled in the rest of the memo to justify it. And some parts of it, like I said, if it weren't such a serious issue, would be laughable, including the head of OLC saying, well, the one way for the Senate to be able to stay in session so the president can't do a recess appointment is to stay in session continuously. So under her opinion, if the United States Senate takes a break for lunch, why then they're in a recess and the president can appoint someone to the NLRB and elsewhere. Like I said, it's a laughable opinion, and it shows how much OLC has been corrupted by Eric Holder.
John Fund, do you want to chime in here?
I can probably participate in one more question, and then I'm afraid I'll have a pressing engagement.
Okay, let's go to our next caller then.
Yes, David Emerson in Berkeley, California. I joined the call a little bit late, so this may have already been asked and answered. But the question has to do with what types of remedies the participants would suggest, in, especially along the lines of extending constitutional protections of due process and equal protection to the discretionary judgments in the office.
Hans, I don't know if you want to go over. We did get some response in this vein, maybe some increased power in the IG's office, maybe revisiting some standing, congressional standing.
We did talk about that before. And by the way, one of the recommendations, as I said, that we talk about, which is that the Inspector General actually be given authority over investigating ethical and professional wrongdoing by members of the staff instead of OPR. That's not just our recommendation. In fact, the current Inspector General of the Justice Department has asked for that. That's in one of his recommendations that he sent to the management of the Justice Department.
Would that require a statutory change for the IG?
Yes,
or?
It would. Yeah.
Okay. Can we take one more question and then I'll have to depart?
Yeah, let's take another question.
Hi, good afternoon. I was calling with a question or a concern about the judiciary itself. In the start of the discussion, you had mentioned the departure that this attorney general has had from all prior administrations, Republican, Democrat, that each of those had maintained a fidelity to their oaths and to their role, and that this has shown a departure from that. My concern is with the judiciary itself. Why wouldn't we expect to see that same departure, the same arc that we've seen over the course of this, sort of as time carries on, that we can no longer rely on the judiciary itself, that they too become an enforcer?
Well, the danger, of course, is a standard slip in one area of our delicately balanced constitutional framework. Standards will ultimately slip everywhere, which is why the rot has to be stopped, and you have to take steps to reverse the rot as quickly as possible, because the rule of law can quickly be morphed into the rule of men overnight. And one of the things that obviously we have to worry about is courts have shown enormous deference, as Hans has mentioned earlier, to federal actions, federal administrative procedures, all kinds of arguments made by the Justice Department. And I think only now are some courts waking up to the fact that this is not your grandfather or your father's Justice Department. But we cannot expect that realization to last. Obviously, President Obama has made appointees to various courts that are going to be very deferential to his view of executive power, and certainly not likely to rule against the Justice Department. So we have to be concerned about this now, because even though our book concerns the Justice Department, the slippage of standards and the erosion of the rule of law is something that can carry throughout our government.
Yeah, I would just add, look, we don't really talk about judges that much in the case, well, except for the judges who've issued decisions castigating the department. But in fact, I will tell you that while I think I do think we potentially have a future problem with many of the judges that have been nominated and unfortunately confirmed of President Obama, I think we're going to see the kind of slippage you are talking about, and you can already see the slippage in an incident that we talk about in the book, which is, you know, we discuss the really betrayal of the adversarial system that we have by Eric Holder deciding that he has the ability to not defend any law passed by Congress that he doesn't like from a public policy standpoint. You know, that is, again, the complete opposite of what prior attorney generals of both parties have said, which is that the attorney general has an obligation to defend laws passed by Congress with except for under very rare exceptions. That is not the attitude of Holder. And as you all may know, shortly before John and I sent the manuscript off to the publisher, Eric Holder actually had a meeting with the state attorney generals across the country. It was a closed door meeting. They took the press out at the end, and he told them they ought to do the same thing. They should stop defending laws that they don't like. And we have already seen a number of attorney generals follow that very bad, very unethical, and what I consider unprofessional advice, such as the Attorney General of Virginia, and decide they are not going to defend laws passed by their state legislatures, which again, simply does not work in the kind of adversarial system we have, where we expect both sides to be argued vigorously in court so that the judges can then make a decision.
I just want to thank Dean for arranging this call. I want to thank Hans for obviously participating in it with me, and I want to thank the audience for listening in. I'm sorry that I can't join with you for the rest of the hour, but I hope we can continue this dialogue and conversation. And again, the book is Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. It's from HarperCollins and available in the usual sales pitch I close with, bookstores and Amazon everywhere.
Thank you, John Fund. And the call will
Thank
continue.
You.
So to our audience members, please continue to hang in there. We have just one caller question pending. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
I wanted to ask about the whistleblower phenomenon. We have the one example of the Civil Rights Division lawyer resigning in protest over the mishandling of the Black Panther election intimidation prosecution. I assume in preparing your book, you didn't have any confidential whistleblower information from inside the department itself. What is the problem with the whistleblower phenomenon? Is it just the risk of being fired, the risk of being pushed off into a corner? And tied to that is a question about the career people who work in the Office of Legal Counsel or the Office of Professional Responsibility. I mean, have they simply been moved aside to handle the dog catcher cases? And so that these major opinions are coming out of new appointee personnel, or how have they dealt with the career people who surely are not willing to write memoranda full of bad law?
Well, I don't want people to think I'm too negative. I worked at the Justice Department. I met very good, very high level professionals there. But you need to understand that for the past 6 years, and this is something else we cover in the book, Eric Holder and his political subordinates have been filling career civil service slots with radical left wing lawyers. They hire almost exclusively from liberal advocacy organizations like La Raza, the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund, the ACLU, and political cronies. And so the career, you know, many of the career ranks now, the people who are in them, have exactly the same views and attitudes as the political appointees. So that will be a continuing problem throughout. I will tell you that I dealt with some of the career people in the Office of Professional Responsibility, and frankly, many of them were just as radical and just as bad as the political appointees that I've just been discussing. So if you want to get an example of that, a good example of just how biased they are, take a look at the report that they tried to issue going after John Yoo for the legal memos that he issued when he was in OLC that outlined what interrogators could and could not do illegally with regard to terrorists. And the issues in that report were unbelievable. Michael Mukasey, the former attorney general, issued a long letter in which he pointed out all of the errors, mistakes, and fallacies in that OPR report. And that is a very good example of, again, the bias problems within the Office of Professional Responsibility. And that has just simply gotten worse in the current administration.
Has that changed in the structure, the personnel structure? Has that occurred in the U.S. attorney's offices across the country also?
Well, I will tell you that, look, there certainly have been problems in the U.S. attorney's office. Again, when I worked at Justice, I met some very good people in the U.S. attorney's offices. But on the other hand, you know, I was talking earlier about the Louisiana case in which the federal judge issued a scathing opinion accusing members of the Justice Department of prosecutorial abuse. That included several lawyers within the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Orleans, including the number two in that office, who was one of the people who was also anonymously blogging and failed to inform the court about that. So some of this, unfortunately, has spread into the U.S. Attorney's offices in some parts of the country.
Our lines are wide open right now. If you have a question for our remaining co-author, Hans von Spakovsky, please push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. I wonder if we can, while we're waiting to see who else might ring in, delve a little bit deeper into the career staff versus political staff issue there and how much change one might expect with a change in administration. What are the numbers like as a veteran there in terms of the numbers of political staff versus career staff? What are the abilities of career staff to be influenced by the political staff? How much control do they really have? How much power do they really have?
They don't have a lot of control. I actually was a career staffer in the Civil Rights Division during the Bush administration, and when I started off in the voting section, it had about 80 staff, about half lawyers, half support staff. I was one of only two known conservatives in that section. And I can tell you, I was treated as if I was an enemy combatant. The fact that a conservative had gotten hired into the career ranks – in the Civil Rights Division was considered an affront to the other longtime career people who were there. I should tell you, the Civil Rights Division is probably the worst division within the entire Justice Department. And so all of the folks being hired now, like the majority of individuals that have been hired into the career slots in the Civil Rights Division, and this is all outlined, by the way, in an Inspector General report from last year about the mismanagement of the Civil Rights Division. Look, they are, by the time a new administration comes in, if we assume, for example, that a Republican is elected president, all these people who would normally be political appointees and who are now in career slots, they're going to be permanent federal employees. And it will be next to impossible for a new administration to get rid of them because of the severe restrictions of the career rules. And I know they will be doing everything they can day to day to fight any changes made by a Republican president. They will fight any change in their priorities. They will fight any attempt to bring them back within the limits of the law instead of acting the way they are now, which is far outside what the federal law says and requires.
We've got two more questions pending now, so let's take another call here.
Hello, Hans. This is Linda Knight in Nashville. Do you have any sense that the general population is waking up to these abuses by the executive branch and the Department of Justice, or is the public either blissfully unaware or willfully ignorant of the abuse and the dangers to our freedoms and constitutional rights?
No, I actually, and hi, Linda. I actually think people are aware of this. You know, there was a poll just released which showed the president's popularity and the confidence of the American people in his leadership abilities to be so low that I think it was Chuck Todd, the correspondent, said that the administration is over. I have found something actually quite remarkable, and that is, you know, I talk to audiences across the country, and normally if you're talking to an ordinary voter, you know, they don't know anything about the cases that the Justice Department handles. But, you know, everybody I talk to, they've all heard of the new Black Panther Party voter intimidation case. You know, they've all heard about this case where these folks in paramilitary uniforms were standing in front of a polling place in Philadelphia in 2008, intimidating voters, yelling racial epithets at individuals. And they all have heard about how Eric Holder dismissed that case. And I think there's a real realization that we have a problematic attorney general, someone for whom politics is a driving force, not the interests of justice.
And I take it the Black Panther case is covered in the book?
It is, in particular, the fact that a federal judge issued a decision in a Freedom of Information Act request that in which he said that basically the sworn testimony of the head of the Civil Rights Division, Tom Perez, that he gave before the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, in which he said no political appointees had been involved in the decision to dismiss the case, a federal judge said that was obviously and clearly wrong, which is an indication that Perez lied under oath. And what was the reaction of Eric Holder and President Obama to that? Why they promoted him. They nominated him to be the Secretary of Labor, and that occurred after a federal judge basically said that he had lied under oath.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question, and then our lines are completely open.
Additional question regarding the follow-up to the Ted Stevens prosecution and then a prosecutorial abuse issue. And secondly, is the constitutionality of the Congress creating an Office of Special Investigator for a particular setting, irrespective of the president's willing to do so? Is that simply off-limits? I don't know the constitutional issues behind that.
Well, I'll tell you, as most people know, the special counsel statute was allowed by Congress to expire. And, of course, that's the provision under which special prosecutors were appointed to investigate many of the Gate scandals, including during the Clinton administration. Frankly, there was always a great deal of argument amongst constitutional scholars and others over whether, in fact, that statute was unconstitutional, because the claim was that it violated separation of powers by having this special statute that set up. Dean, I'm getting a lot of background noise. Hello?
Yeah, we can still hear you, Hans. I was able to mute that phone that was giving
us. Oh, okay. Thank you.
There
was always a great deal of debate over whether the special prosecutor statute that allowed judges to set up appoint a special prosecutor and the rules, whether that violated separation of powers. And that is an unanswered question. I don't have an answer one way or the other, except to say that I think there were serious questions about that. Because of the expiration of that statute, the only way a so-called special prosecutor can get appointed is if the attorney general appoints a special prosecutor. Now, that happened during the Bush administration when the attorney general appointed Patrick Fitzgerald to investigate the leak of the identification of Valerie Flame as a CIA agent. But that is a very different procedure, because that simply is the attorney general appointing a current employee of the Justice Department, usually a U.S. attorney, and giving them independent authority to make decisions. In other words, they can decide whether to prosecute or not without getting the okay of the attorney general. So they're really not completely independent prosecutors. This attorney general, Eric Holder, has refused all requests to appoint a special prosecutor, including in the most recent issue that is hitting the news, which, of course, is the IRS scandal, the loss of all those emails. And, this is a situation that really there ought to be a special prosecutor, because, as you all know, we now have evidence that Lois Lerner turned over a million pages of confidential taxpayer information to the Justice Department in an effort to get them to criminally prosecute conservative organizations. So that calls into question the entire supposed criminal investigation being conducted by the Justice Department, the IRS scandal, because they may have been involved in potential wrongdoing. And yet, even in this situation, the Attorney General refuses to appoint a semi-independent counsel.
Where is let me ask it once more for questions from the audience. Push the star button and then the pound button if you'd like to have ask a question. Our lines are open. What's the role or the involvement in any of this in the White House counsel's office? If you could explain that to some of our listeners who might not be aware of the White House counsel's office versus the Justice Department versus OLC and what happens there in the interactions.
Normally the Office of White House Counsel's job is to provide advice directly to the president. They are not supposed to be involved in decisions made by the Attorney General over cases handled by the Department of Justice, whether it's decisions over cases they are prosecuting or decisions over cases where the government has been sued and the Justice Department is defending. But this White House, and particularly the White House Counsel's Office, has unfortunately interfered in some of the cases handled by the Justice Department. In fact, we talk about one of them. We have a chapter on the Pigford case. This is probably the biggest scam ever perpetrated on the American taxpayers. This was a settlement entered into by the Justice Department to pay off claims by black farmers, women, Indian, and Hispanic farmers who claimed that the Department of Agriculture discriminated against them in providing them with loans when compared to white farmers. The Justice Department, as we explain in the book, actually said that the second Pigford lawsuit, which had been filed by women, Indians, and Hispanics, was completely bogus. There was no evidence of discriminatory conduct by the Department of Agriculture. The Justice Department prosecutors said they could win the case, as did their experts. However, this White House, the White House counsel's office, called a meeting at the White House with the Justice Department prosecutors and said to them, basically, that they would settle. They were instructed to settle the case, despite the fact that the government could have won it. And the reason was very clear. They wanted to use taxpayer money to pay off and make large payments to the Hispanics, Indians, and women farmers in this particular case because they thought it would help them in upcoming elections. And so that there is an example, unfortunately, of the White House counsel's office getting involved in something it shouldn't have and helping to perpetrate what a Department of Agriculture employee called, and I quote, the largest scam against federal taxpayers in the history of the United States.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Hans, one of our earlier callers asked about the level of knowledge out there in the public. It makes me wonder how your book's being received, how the reviews are going, what kind of feedback you're getting from readers and that sort of thing.
Well, we've been getting pretty good feedback. Folks who have picked up the book will see that it was endorsed by Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, by Mark Levin, the radio talk show host, and by Luther Strange, who's the attorney general of Alabama. And we've had a number of very positive reviews of it. So I'm actually hopeful that the word about this will get out and that people will take a look at it because, like I said, it's got information they need to know. Why? Because the Justice Department, as John said earlier, it is one of the most powerful cabinet agency departments that there is. It can make or break anyone or any business when it abuses its powers, and that is extremely dangerous to our liberty and our freedom.
The book title, again, by the way, is Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. We've got another caller with a question, so let's take another question.
How do you do? Ted Arujo, I'm an attorney in Syracuse, New York. Is there anything like a private right of action? I think I know the answer to this question, but to get people familiar with this, is there any suit you can bring to turn around the settlements? Or is there any private right of action that can be enforced in the federal courts?
The only way that can happen is if a party, for example, an industry that might be affected by an environmental regulation, if they have any ability to find out about the settlement before it becomes final, you know, they can try to file a motion to intervene. But other than that, no, I'm not aware of any kind of private right of action. And there is a bill in Congress, by the way, that would call for greater transparency. It would basically require any time a lawsuit is filed and a settlement is proposed by the Justice Department, that be made public before the settlement agreement is filed and before the settlement agreement can be approved by a judge to, in fact, give the public and businesses and members of industry who might be affected by it the opportunity to find out about it and to potentially intervene in the lawsuit to tell the judge why this would be a bad settlement.
Well, I expect that would be some sort of federal register notice, Hans, or is it?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Right.
Well, plus, actually, this bill would call for and not just stuff in the Federal Register, but for the Justice Department, for example, and the Treasury Department, because the Treasury Department runs a fund that is called the Judgment Fund. This is a fund that's actually used to pay off all kinds of lawsuits against the government. It actually calls for, you know, we're in the Internet age, and this bill would require things like that to get posted at the web pages of the Treasury Department and the Justice Department so that people could easily check it every day to see, you know, new lawsuits that have been filed, settlement agreements that have been proposed, and get all kinds of information like that.
Maybe even sign up for email alerts. Let's take another call here from from our audience?
In terms of right of action by private parties, there is the Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Acts of 1964, which gives a
right.
private right of action. I realize there's a problem in funding such actions, but for example, the new Black Panther voter intimidation case, it seems to me that voters in that precinct could have been found and civil rights actions could have been brought by private parties represented and funded by political action groups, no doubt, but with the potential for damages, not criminal penalties, but damages. It seems to me there could be creative use of that civil rights statute or private rights of action in strategic areas for the purpose of making a legal headway and political and public opinion headway.
Oh yeah, listen, that's actually a very good point, and I'm glad you brought that up. You are absolutely right, but I'll tell you that, and I know this as a civil rights lawyer who practices civil rights division, Section 1983 over the years has been almost exclusively used by liberal advocacy groups. Hardly any conservative groups have used it. And I think part of it is because conservative groups are frankly outnumbered and out-resourced by the left, and so they haven't had the resources to use the statute the way they should. But I think conservatives are getting smarter about this, and I'll give you a very specific and a recent example that shows that. And that is, there's been this huge scandal in Wisconsin recently with local prosecutors there using what they call the John Doe statute to conduct this far-ranging, abusive investigation of 30, basically all, of the center to center-right conservative advocacy organizations in Wisconsin. And one of the groups went to court, filed a 1983 civil rights action against these local prosecutors, and recently was successful in getting an injunction against the prosecutors by the judge who was very critical of what the prosecutors were doing, basically saying that they were violating the First Amendment rights of these advocacy organizations, and also, very importantly, refused to give sovereign immunity to the prosecutors, which they were claiming even against this 1983 action. So that action is going to go forward, and I hope actually that the conservative organizations there get damages and attorney's fees against those local prosecutors.
Well, we're just about out of time. I want to give you a chance before we adjourn to wrap up or express a final thought if you have one.
Well, I would just say that I know I wrote the book, and so therefore we would like people to get it, but I actually think it is a worthwhile read for not just lawyers, but for the general public, because oftentimes federal agencies in Washington operate under the radar. The media doesn't cover them. That's certainly the case here. If a Republican attorney general had engaged in the kind of behavior that Holder has, it would have been constant front page news at the Washington Post and the New York Times. All those media outlets have basically been passive and, in fact, have helped the Attorney General by not covering the kinds of abuses that he and the people who work for him have engaged in. So from that point of view, I think it's important for people to read this so they are well informed about the kind of things that are going on, unfortunately, in the chief law enforcement agency of the United States.
And once again, the book we've been talking about is titled Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. You know where to get it. My thanks to John Fund and, of course, to you, Hans von Spakovsky, for joining us today. This has certainly been an enlightening, somewhat troubling call. To our audience, a reminder that our next scheduled teleforum conference call, this was just put on the schedule, is now tomorrow at 2 p.m. when we'll be talking about today's Supreme Court decision, patent decision, Alice Corp versus CLS Bank. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.